This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
And good morning, Roger. Good morning, world. We're coming to you from WGN West in Scottsdale, Arizona for just a few more days. But Roger, I can't tell you, that talk of flash flooding and rain is so foreign to what's going on here in the desert in the Valley of the Sun, that where they haven't had rain for 87 days.
I've been following that out there about the high heat and the lack of rain. That's very hazardous.
And if it gets windy at all, they really get concerned. We had an interstate yesterday that wasn't shut down, but boy, traffic was moving at 10 to 15 miles an hour. And again, because of the dry weather and the wildfires alongside the Interstate 17, which goes from Phoenix up north to Flagstaff. And so, but as we always say in the desert, and I've only been in the desert about 22 years for brief times, it's a dry heat. The humidity, 5% yesterday with 108 degree temperatures. So it's a dry heat, Roger.
Yeah, we said the same thing when I lived in Vegas.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Indeed. Well, we'll be talking about weather. We'll be talking about markets. We'll talk about the ongoing trade meetings that are taking place. It's going to be quite a weekend on Wall Street and in the agricultural markets because of the meeting in Singapore with North Korea coming up. And right now, we've got the G7 meeting going on in Quebec. And that's kind of a tense meeting as well, because the countries involved in that are not happy with some of the trade tariffs and the effective retaliation taking place in this game that we call world trade. So we're going to also look in on June Dairy Month in across the country, but particularly in Wisconsin, where I think they hold more June Dairy Month breakfasts on the farm, well, I know, than any other state. We're going to be talking to John Onken of the Agri-Dairy Business Letter about that activity and also about the ongoing financial challenge facing the dairy industry right now. And, of course, they're watching the NAFTA renegotiations because Mexico is a major market for U.S. pork. And Canada has a dairy quota system that dairy farmers here feel are not to the benefit of the North American dairy industry. So all of that coming up as we're with you here this morning at 13 minutes after 5. We're going to check in with John when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. It's June Dairy Month, as you've heard me say many, many times, and we certainly couldn't let June Dairy Month go for the entire time without talking to John Onken, who is publisher of the Agri-Dairy Business Letter, based in Madison, Wisconsin, and who I refer to a great deal here on the Saturday Morning Show. So, John, happy June Dairy Month to you.
Well, I've been to one breakfast already and going to another one on tomorrow.
Well, that was going to be my first question, because I counted, and I thought I counted over 60 June Dairy Month breakfasts in Wisconsin. Is that anywhere near right?
I was going to say 64, but that's pretty close.
And I know you won't be able to make all of them, but tell me about where the one you have already visited and what happened there.
Well, I attended Green Counties. They don't call it a dairy breakfast. They call it the breakfast on the farm. But it's the same menu, and it's like all of the other dairy breakfasts. It was May 28th near Monticello, Wisconsin, on a farm that raises calves, raises brown Swiss calves. for the Vagley Farms, which is a couple miles away, well-known international Brown Swiss herd. And they estimated about 5,000 people showed up for breakfast. $7 a piece for adults, pretty good deal. You can't even do that in a restaurant.
No.
That includes ice cream sundaes and music and you name it. It's a full morning.
But with that many people, it must take, what, 4 or 5 hours to serve everybody?
Well, they start, I believe, at 6 and ran till 10, 4 hours. But they had 3 serving lines. They have all of these are run by volunteers, dairy people, farmers, community people, agricultural businesses and what have you. And they have hundreds of volunteers involved in this, and they use a large griddle and scramble eggs, and it goes off very smoothly.
Well, if I recall, the Wisconsin Dairy Farm Breakfast on the Farm have access to what's billed as the world's biggest fry pan?
Well, that was true up until a few years ago when the county, and the fellow by name you probably knew, Bob Williams, he was the head of the that segment of the Department of Agriculture, and he put together a couple of these fry pans. I think they were 4 or 5 feet wide. And then the counties, rather than haul them back and forth, some of them had them made and share them among themselves. So, but the recipe is about the same of the scrambled eggs.
Now, this was a heifer-raising farm, so people were not able to see cows actually being milked?
No, there were no cows on the farm. It was a former Holstein, registered Holstein herd until the husband died of cancer a few years ago, and his wife wanted to continue farming, and so she began raising heifers for the Vagley farm up the road. And she has about 60 of them that she's feeding at any given time. But so, there's nothing cuter than a Brown Swiss calf.
Yeah, you're right.
Even cuter than cows.
So now let's talk about what people can see when they go to a farm where they're actually milking cows. Is it possible to get in and watch the cows being milked?
Well, it varies by county. They used to until, remember, years ago, what was it, the foot and mouth disease or
right.
whatever?
Yeah.
10 years ago, and they... many of the farms don't allow people to walk into the building anymore. I'm going to the Dane County breakfast, which will be Saturday the 9th, and I don't know what their plans are, but they usually have a way to see them. And it's a good idea if the city folks who aren't familiar with dairying can see cows milk, but... I don't know. It varies by county.
Right.
And it's always a thrill for people. They don't know where milk comes from, but they finally learn.
And they don't know where ice cream, cheese, butter, and yogurt comes from either. But, yeah, you do learn when you get to a dairy farm.
Well, you get to talk to actual farmers besides.
Yeah. Right. Now, you've been spending quite a bit of time recently in your newsletter on the financial challenge facing dairy farmers today and the monthly loss of dairy farms in Wisconsin. Bring me up to date on that, please.
Well, last year we lost 500 licensed dairy farms. It's been much publicized, but that's not a large figure. We've lost many more in some months over the last 30 years. But I think the issue now that's there's a dairy plant at Hollandtown, south of Green Bay, owned by Arla, a Danish-headquartered cooperative that's multi-billion dollars. They released 11 dairy farms, said they weren't going to take their milk anymore. That was a couple of weeks ago. And to my knowledge, these 11 farms don't have a home for their milk. I called one of them a couple of days ago, milks 100 cows, 30,000-pound average, which makes it a outstanding herd, mm-hmm. and they still don't have an idea what's going to happen to their milk by the end of June. And then there's a 1,300-cow dairy herd among those 11 that were received a notice from the dairy. So I don't know what they're going to do. I can't get a handle on that at all. And as far as I know, they don't know either.
Because if there's not a cheese factory or if there's not a dairy, where can a farmer go? Are they dumping milk or will they have to dump milk?
Well, they haven't really faced that crucial point yet. They're dumping milk out in Pennsylvania and New York, however.
Right.
And in the Northeast, and have been doing it for a year or so. But we haven't dumped in Wisconsin, to my knowledge, yet. I hope they'll find somebody who'll pick them up. That 1,300-cow herd is that's a lot of milk. And when I think they figured out that the 11 farms have 200,000 pounds of milk a day.
You're right. That is a lot of milk.
But other farmers are concerned now about this whole thing. The cooperative rules, the members of cooperatives are somewhat fortified against it because the cooperative must continue to pick up milk from all of their patrons. That doesn't say anything about the price, but the co-op members who send milk to co-ops are probably somewhat better off.
Well,
I know a farmer friend of mine who joined DFA. He was released a couple months ago by a dairy, and he sold his cows. He went out of business recently.
But those cows went somewhere else, and they're still producing.
I'm assuming so, yes.
Right. Well, it's a far different time than when you and I were growing up on a farm, and the milk truck came in and picked up the milk tanks out of the water cooler and hauled them to the creamery. Big change today, isn't it?
I'm not sure I'd want to drink the milk we produced in those days, Arjen.
Yeah, you're
right. We didn't have good coolers and pipeline milkers in those days, and it was much more handled by hand. And it wasn't cooled as rapidly as now. But yeah, we survived very well.
Yeah, we did. We survived. So, well, I appreciate getting caught up on what's happening most recently to the industry. And why aren't you making all 64 breakfasts, John?
I'm lucky to make two.
Okay.
By the way, the cheese market went up today, $0.03 or $0.04 in both block and barrel, so they'll be encouraged. The dairy industry will be somewhat encouraged.
We're still making a lot of cheese in Wisconsin, aren't we?
Too much.
Yeah, you're right. John, you have a good weekend and enjoy your next breakfast on the farm, and we'll stay in touch.
Thanks for calling, Orion.
Okay, John Onken, who is publisher of the Agridairy Business Letter in Madison, Wisconsin, with us here on the Saturday Morning Show. And we're at about 29 minutes after 5 o'clock on a wet Saturday over much of the Midwest as flash flood warnings are in the forecast. Well, Roger will have that for you in just a minute or two. I want to share just a brief summary of a newspaper article written by a Canadian writer in the Toronto Globe and Mail. This is quoting a Canadian now, and this is what this person had to say. The essence of Canada's posture in the deepening trade feud with the Trump administration is that we are the victims. We have been hit with tariffs on steel and aluminum, even though the United States sells far more of these products than we sell them. The pending threat of U.S. tariffs on vehicles is similarly egregious, given that Canada has experienced a sharp drop in auto production and investment in the past decade. And the United States is demanding major concessions in NAFTA talks, even though the U.S. enjoys a small overall goods and services trade surplus with Canada. Surely, if anyone is getting a raw deal, it's us in Canada. There is, however, at least one notable outlier, and Donald Trump has railed about it repeatedly, and that's Canada's dairy and poultry practices. Canada charges the U.S. a 270% tariff on dairy products. They didn't tell you that, did they? Not fair to our farmers, the U.S. president tweeted Friday before boarding Air Force One to head to the Group of Seven leaders meeting in Quebec, Canada. And the Canadian writer says Mr. Trump is absolutely right that Canada's markets in dairy, chickens, eggs, and turkeys are protected by restrictive barriers. That's a Canadian writer writing in the Toronto Globe and Mail about the issues that we're undergoing right now. Thank you very much, Roger. And we've got a lot to cover between now and 6 o'clock. We begin by saying welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products Company, makers of quality, specialty cleaning products since 1947. I am Orion Samuelson, this week talking about something we all talk about daily, weather. The folks at Wink Products Company want to help make your life easier with a family of professional strength cleaning products. Wink Rust Stain Remover is the number one liquid rust stain remover in the country. This professional strength formula dissolves the ugly rust stains on white sinks and toilet bowls. The little brown bottle has been around for 70 years and it's still number one. Check us out at wink.com. That's WHINK.com. Having been in the broadcast industry for over six decades, I remember the changes that I've seen, not only in technology, but in stories that we cover. There was a time in my early days of broadcasting, the weather forecast got about 30 seconds to a minute to tell you if it was going to rain or if there was going to be a blizzard, but that was about it. But my, how that has changed. Television news, it has become a major story, taking anywhere from 3 to 5 minutes out of a newscast. And I've been in Arizona for the past 3 weeks, where indeed it has been getting a lot of attention as we finally hit the first 100-degree day. And then a few days ago, the first 110-degree day in the desert. And it was a major story. And we spent a lot of time talking about how we deal with hot weather, how we deal with cold weather if you're in a Midwest blizzard. And it has become a major story. But before all of that, it was a major point of conversation at every gathering of farmers around the country. And I remember very much that at rural coffee shops, the number one topic, well, maybe number two, it goes back and forth, but the two major topics of interest for farmers and ranchers, weather and markets. But with our ability now, satellite coverage and everything, we can be a lot more accurate on weather. And it does change dramatically. I'm just looking at the past 2 or 3 months. We've already had the beginning of the tropical depression or hurricane storm season. We've also had severe drought in the southern plains wheat country of the United States. But we've had drought in crop areas of Brazil and Argentina, and certainly weather concerns for the wheat crop in Ukraine and Russia. And it does create interest, because it does impact food available and prices charged. So at that morning breakfast gathering at the coffee shop, yeah, keep talking about weather. You can't change it, but you can certainly talk about it and what it will do to your market prices. My thoughts on Samuelson Says, a presentation of Tribune Radio Networks, and we have Max standing by to check in with a couple of reports when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show.
Well, let's head to the field for a couple of minutes this weekend to talk with one of the folks from BASF. Jack Marshall joins us here. First of all, Jack, let's talk about moisture conditions out there before we get to talking about weeds. And the two subjects certainly are not unrelated, but I'm hearing of these dry pockets, very dry pockets, that might have missed some of that Alberto moisture of last week. What are you hearing from your clients?
Yeah, Max, I'm hearing things kind of all over the board, where last week with the Alberto or the remnants of Alberto, we got, 2 to 3 inches. So those guys are actually a little too wet. But then we've got other areas that have had maybe an inch total in this entire cropping season. So moisture levels are kind of all over the board, but we've still got some time to make those up. There's some good soil moisture as well out there in these fields.
Are we starting to see a little greening between the rows in some instances of those newly planted soybeans, or has our control been pretty good to this point?
Our control has been pretty good, but with the rain that we've had, it's time for these residuals that we've started with in these soybean fields. They're starting to break down. They've been out for a month or so. They're starting to break down, and so we're starting to see with this rain water hemp shoot through and shoot up, and it's time to start thinking about how we're going to keep that controlled all season long.
What guidance do you give the growers?
First thing I say is I have a zero tolerance policy on water hemp. You see it, you spray it. Ideally, we want to make sure that we're getting out there before we see the water hemp emerge. And I know that sounds counterintuitive to a lot of growers across Illinois in the listing area, but the best thing we can do is we need to prevent water hemp and any other weeds, for that matter, from even emerging. And we do that by using a layered residual program with products like Outlook Herbicide or Zidua Herbicide to keep fields clean all season long.
At this stage in the game, if you don't control the water hemp, what happens?
So if you don't think about controlling water hemp early, when it's less than 4 inches, and it doesn't matter if you're using the Xtend soybean system, a Liberty Link soybean system, traditional Roundup system or non-GMO, if you try to go after big water hemp, you've already got a disaster on your hands, and a rescue treatment isn't going to be that effective. So we need to think about how we can control water hemp when it's small, ideally when it's 2 inches or less. So we need to start thinking about how we can get out there early and then use whatever post-herbicide option you have available. In the Xtend system, we've got Ingenia. If you're Liberty Link system, you have Liberty that works very, very well. And we also have the post-applied PPO option if you're using a Roundup on a Roundup acre or a non-GMO acre as well. Let's look at the next step. And the next step after we get these herbicides sprayed is, what are we doing to protect that crop through the really important time in soybeans, which is fungicide season? So looking and evaluating stands, evaluating fields to see if they're good fits for a pre-Axor fungicide application at the R3 timing or towards the end of July, early August.
We got off to such a good start, it would be a terrible thing to waste yield potential. Weather can do enough to that, can't it?
Yeah, weather can do enough to that. And, in a lot of the fields that I'm looking at, even though we could use some rain, soybeans are really resilient. And we got off to a great start. We've got great stands. If we can keep the weeds controlled, which a lot of our customers are doing a really good job at, most of the fields that I'm looking at have even stands, no water holes, and they're excellent candidates for that late-season fungicide application.
You make a good point. There are so few of those water holes. Now, I know right within the sound of our voices, there are growers who really were dumped on, in fact, in that subtropical moisture that came up a few days ago. But generally speaking, there are far fewer drowned-out spots this spring, aren't there?
Yeah, I would say that this year is probably the fewest number of drowned-out spots I've seen since back to 2012, where the taps really shut off after we got stuff planted. So fields are looking good. They're looking even. Great candidates for intense management throughout the rest of the season.
Jack, we appreciate the visit. Jack Marshall joining us with BASF. The ever-interesting grain market scene gets a little more interesting this time of year in many years. Clayton Pope Commodities, joining us in the studio this weekend. Now, I, of course, should note the fact that it wasn't very interesting for producers in many of the past few days, as we've seen corn and soybean market erosion. Is that solely based on crop bulletins, crop progress, crop conditions?
Well, there's always so many factors at play, Max, as you know, but I think a big part of the problem right now is the funds really kind of got ahead of themselves, just buying the heck out of the corn and bean markets, reached net long positions that were huge from historical perspective, and maybe jumped the gun a little bit. You know, it's still pretty early in the crop development process, and it's just kind of like you have to feed the bull, and it kind of ran out of food for a while, let alone a little bit of negative news, you know, via weather and some trade concerns. So I think you're seeing them bleed a little bit.
But condition ratings have been pretty good.
Absolutely. They've been excellent, to the surprise of a lot of people, I think. Certainly a lot of the producers we talk to are feeling better and better about their crops, but the uniform feeling I get from people is that as good as these conditions look right now, the word I keep hearing is fragile. The subsoil moisture is pretty low. It wouldn't take a whole lot more heat without moisture, you know, to kind of put the brakes on these crop improvements, I'd think. But we are, you know, expected to get some rain here in the next week or so, and I think that's absolutely critical that we do.
Let the record show that when condition ratings are high as the season starts, they tend to fall. Not always, as we saw in recent years, but they almost always go down.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're starting at such a high point here. I mean, it's certainly, I would guess, best case scenario as far as crop development, you know, versus condition ratings is, you know, sideways in the ratings. It'd be almost impossible for them to rise from this level at this time of year.
We do, as we look at the drought monitor, see some interesting spots to watch. And I pointed out simply because I looked at one of Tom Skilling's weather maps this week for the moisture in the week ahead. He was looking, and this was on the Tribune page, as I recall, at some fairly good moisture amounts over much of the Corn Belt. But a notable exception was Missouri that was going to be left out. They're pretty doggone dry already, aren't they?
They really are. The northeast part of Missouri, for sure, which would be, you know, their main production area, in that southern small part of Iowa as well, and even west central Illinois up around that area it has some extremely dry areas. So you know how it is. It's going to be so frustrating for those poor producers in those areas to keep reading all these headlines about the amazing rains, the amazing crop conditions, and they're like, what the heck? Every wet forecast I get fails to materialize. You know, when's it going to change? But welcome to farming, I guess.
We have some of those growers sitting very close to us here in the Chicago area where we're recording this broadcast, because I know when that Alberto moisture came through the other day, there were some growers, for example, along the Illinois-Indiana state line around Kankakee County and over into Newton County, Indiana, in that area, who missed much of that moisture. They didn't get much out of it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And
they need it now.
Oh, they need it very badly. And Indiana, even, they were hurting real bad. And matter of fact, there was a story just yesterday in some of the Indianapolis papers talking about its extreme dry conditions there. But Alberta did give them a very helpful boost. They hit about an inch and a quarter in some of the driest areas there. But, you know, these kind of 95-degree temps, an inch of rain is only going to last so long.
So this moisture that is in the forecast, as we look to the week ahead, is really, really critical from the market standpoint, isn't it?
It is critical, and it seems like there's some pretty good uniformity amongst the forecasters that it's going to happen, but who knows? You know. But another thing I want to say, though, is when you read the Twitter sphere and talk to a lot of people and so forth, you get the feeling that a lot of the trade or followers think that 4th of July and pollination is it. You know, if it's cool and rainy during that week, then this crop is absolutely made. And believe me, I'm not saying that it's not important. It's absolutely hugely important. But even then, I mean, the rest of the summer does matter, even to the corn crop.
Well, and then the soybean market, I mean, we can throw a lot at it right now.
Right.
And still wind up with remarkable yields, can't we?
Oh, absolutely. It's almost what happens right now is irrelevant for the bean crop, it seems like to me.
We have a World Ag Supply Demand Report coming up fairly soon. What's your feeling about what it might show? This one, isn't this the one that can really, really jar the market? Haven't we seen that historically
at
times?
Yeah, we have. I think the July one might be more so, just because we'll have that June acreage update in between. On June 29th, I think, is when that is. But, yeah, even this report, I think, is important, not so much from the U.S. as the world production numbers. I think we're almost certain to see a reduction in Argentine and Brazilian corn production numbers. And the world carryover in corn is already at, 4 or 5 year low or something like that. You take another 3.5 million metric tons off that, and it's going to get a little bit snugger, which makes the ongoing and relentless weakness in corn a little bit of a head scratcher, if you ask me.
If that report turns out, let's say it turns out to be bearish. Let's say there isn't a reduction in the supplies that the trade is expecting.
You mean the USDA could surprise us?
How long-lived would that report be in the market? In other words, regardless of how bearish it is, could the impact be soft simply because it's so much about U.S. weather right now?
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point, actually, because you know, the whole market process is a discounting mechanism, and it's been chewing on these private South American production estimates for a long time. And in typical fashion, the USDA tends to be a little behind the curve in terms of foreign production updates, and you get the whole host of private people, and you know, not only South American firms but or government agencies and U.S. Firms all throwing their numbers out there and so forth. But with very few exceptions, they're almost the whole street is lower than the USDA's numbers, but and so absolutely right. A lot of that is baked into the market at this point, I'd say. So let's just say they came out unchanged, which would be bearish, I would think. That would, brother, be the last thing in the world this corn market needs, right. That's for sure. So it would just take that much more of a severe turn in the weather to really give the bulls some hope here.
From the standpoint of the producer who's looking at this and thinking, doggone it, we missed an opportunity maybe the other day, what kind of guidance do you offer? Do you think there's another good shot here somewhere for marketing corn?
Again, dealing with or looking at corn specifically, I'm not giving up, and maybe I'm I don't want to be naive, and you know, you don't want to be married to your position or whatever. But when you look at the market right now, I mean, amazingly, our price of Dease corn right now, 401, 402, is almost literally exactly what it was a year ago. And our carryover is 23% less. It's like 500 million bushels less than what the current crop year's carryover was a year ago. So you look at that, there really is next to no risk premium in these prices right now. Add to that the fact, I think the USDA started with too high of a yield. I mean, they're assuming 174 for national yield. That's the third highest yield ever, you know, largely because of the last 2 years have been phenomenal. And I think they're underestimating demand. I mean, like I just said, whether they change the South American corn production numbers or not on Tuesday, they're already significantly lower than you know the early in the year forecasts were. As such, I was absolutely shocked when USDA came out with their first new crop U.S. Corn supply and demand. They lowered exports by 125 million, and they raised beans by 225 million. It just seems backwards to me to think that we'll export less corn next year than this year. I'll believe it when I see it. So I don't know. I think the demand side is encouraging, and the supply side is on the world basis is getting smaller. So I'm not really throwing the towel at all on this corn market.
And look at the calendar. It's early, isn't it?
It is
early
very
in the
early.
Season.
Yep.
Clayton, thank you for the visit. We appreciate it. Clayton Pope in the studio this weekend.
And that means we are completing our final broadcast from this studio at WGN Radio as we make the final move to our new location at 303 East Wacker. Thanks to Bob Ferguson, and I'll ask Bob to turn out the lights when we're all done, because he does everything else during this hour here on WGN. So let me remind you, you can win a 2018 Chevy Silverado. And for details, listen to Steve Cochran weekday mornings at 7:20 on 7:20 WGN Chicago. And if you're a smart speaker user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. Thank you for joining us here on the Saturday Morning Show. We will be back next week, but at a different location.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.